The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the grayish.
I miss color.
Or when you are sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
Proving critics wrong is a powerful source of motivation for many professional sports people. For Christian Danner, a lack of support back home in Germany wasn't going to stop him racing in Formula One.
I had a fundamental problem in the eyes of the German journalists because I had long hair, I had an earring, and I had a certain amount of intellectual levels. Everybody thought I'm too bright to drive a racing car. To an extent, it almost killed my career. I just love motor racing. I'm now 66 years of age. I've done a quarter of a century, really, without missing a single Grand Prix. You don't do that unless you really love it.
Racing in the 1980s, in an era of pre-qualifying and poor reliability, Danner never got to show his true ability in an F1 car. But he certainly left his mark on the sport in other ways.
I was the first driver in the history of Formula One that got disqualified because of dangerous driving. The guy who saved my ass at the end of the day was Ayrton Senna, because Senna was following and he could see what happened and he knew exactly that I didn't do anything wrong. And he then initiated this little PR conference just out of the blue saying, that guy Danner, he's not done anything wrong. And that saved my ass in Germany because everybody thought, no, that guy is nuts. I mean, how can he be disqualified because of dangerous driving?
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. September 1985 was life-changing for Christian Danner. In the space of a week, he made his Formula One debut at the Belgian Grand Prix, and he became the first ever champion of the International Formula 3000 Championship. That's the equivalent of winning in Formula 2 today. Over the following four seasons, Christian raced for Osella, Arrow, Zaxspeed, and Riel in F1, but he was the first of many F3000 champions who struggled to make a real impression at the pinnacle of motorsport. Jean Alesi, Olivier Panis, and Juan Pablo Montoya are the only previous champions who've gone on to win an F1 race. But Danner absolutely loved competing in Formula One, and as a commentator for German TV today, his passion for the sport oozes just as strongly off track as it did when he was in the thick of the action on track. Christian tells me why he moved to the UK to pursue his motor racing ambitions, what impact a lack of support from German media had on him, and he shares his memories of his first F1 test with Bernie Eccleston's Brabham team. He also talks about his bizarre disqualification at Monaco in 1987 and why Ayrton Senna came to his defence. And what it was like being teammates with Martin Brundle and how he climbed from P26 on the grid to P4 at the flag at the 1989 US Grand Prix for his best ever finish. It's a real pleasure to hear Christian's enthusiasm for Formula One back then and today, and it's clear how grateful he is to have had the privilege of racing at the highest level. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Christian, it's great to have you on the show. How are things?
Well, things are pretty good. I can't complain. And it's great to be on the show because, you know, my girlfriend's son, he keeps listening to this. And he complained. He said, Christian, why have you never appeared on that thing? I mean, his name is Maxence. And he said, well, I said, well, they're probably not interested in me. And they are, well, I'm too boring or something. It's got to be something like that. So to great surprise, you invited me to come. Here I am, and I'm happy to be here.
And Max, this one is for you.
Yeah, it's a very special one, yeah.
Now, Christian, these days you are a TV commentator, but of course you made your name as a hugely versatile racing driver, Formula 3000, IndyCar, sports cars, touring cars, and of course, Formula One. You've done it all, but how important was it for you to have Formula One on the CV?
Well, that's what I always wanted to do. So it was the most important thing of all things that I had in mind. And after I won the 3000 championship, it was, you know, it was pretty clear that I want to spend as much time as possible in Formula One. And, you know, any kind of young race car driver wants to end up in Formula One. And it's never been easy. It's always been as difficult as it is now. Maybe there were more cars, but it's always been difficult to actually get there. So I was quite pleased when I actually managed and, did what I could.
As you say, you won that inaugural F3000 championship in 1985. You know, with that championship in your back pocket, how confident were you of getting the leg up with a decent team?
Well, you know, young race car drivers have got that. Are actually suffering from an extraordinary phenomenon, which is called optimism. And for me, it was crystal clear that, you know, now having crossed off the 3000 championship, next step is winning the Formula One World Championship. Of course, you know, at that time in life, the sky is the limit, you know, everything's wide open and you're good enough to beat them all. And that was how I approached the whole thing. And I never had any doubt that I was, you know, not perfectly fit and fast enough for Formula One. I was pretty confident, which I think is quite normal.
Totally normal.
It's not only normal, it's bloody necessary, isn't it?
Christian, so you get the leg up with Zach Speed. I did want to ask you this. Did you jump too quickly into that car? Were there other opportunities maybe with teams further up the grid?
Well, you know, in retrospect, you know, you can always say it should have been better like this, or it could have been better like that. But at the end of the day, you've got to take what's there. And in 1985, I was racing in the 3000 championship, which I won. I was racing in the World Endurance Championship, which whatever it was called then, Long Distance Championship of Group C cars, the whole year, every race. I did all the 24-hour races, Nürburgring, Spa, the tin-top, the touring car races. I did my first ever Grand Prix, where I did two Grand Prix when Jonathan Palmer had a broken leg, I think it was. So I stood in for him. And at the end of the year, after my first Formula One Grand Prix, I did my first Formula 3 race. So at that time, I didn't ask. I just went for whatever was available, simply because I had to earn money. And that's because I had to spend the money with 3000, with Bob Sparshot, and I gave him every penny I earned. So that's how we got through the year. And there was no choice, you know. You wait for a better chance in Formula One. If there's a chance, jump in and go.
That sounds like an amazing season with so much going on. But when you look at today's stars, you know, who specialize, they only race in Formula One. Was all that different experience in tin tops, in sports cars, in F3, in F3000 and Formula One all in one year, did that make you a better driver, or actually was there too much going on?
No, there wasn't too much going on. You know, generally speaking, there is a significant difference between a single-seater, which I call a racing car, and a tin top, which I call a car you can race with. There is a fundamental difference. Single-seaters are proper racing cars with a lot of cornering speed, with a lot of downforce, and they're just thoroughbred racing cars. Everything aside is something that you can drive quickly, you can go racing with. But if you know the difference, you know how to cope with it and you know how to drive these things. I never had a problem, say, jumping from an Arrows BMW Formula One car into a 300 brake horsepower BMW or something. It wasn't a problem because I knew how it was like, because I always did everything. Not because I thought it's the best idea to become the most experienced driver of all times. I just did it because I had to. So I knew where the difference was and I could cope with it, no problem.
Now, this was the pre-Schumacher era, just of Formula One. Was there a lot of support for German drivers back home?
No, there was nothing. I mean, I had a fundamental problem in the eyes of the German journalists, which was quite simple because I had long hair, I had an earring, and I had a certain amount of intellectual level. So I was actually qualified to go and study at the university, which everybody thought I'm too bright to drive a racing car. And that was to an extent where it almost killed my career. Because remember Paul Roscher, the famous BMW engine man, and he came to me one day and he said, well, in his typically Bavarian accent, you know, he said, Mr. Danner, I think you should go back to university because this is motor racing. You're overqualified for this. And I said, well, Mr. Roscher, I want to go racing and that's why I'm here. So no, I'm not going to go back to university. So that was a bit of a discussion we had. Eventually, I won. But it just shows you that in my career, there was two things that were kind of difficult. One was this, the actual upbringing and the fact that I was not a mechanic or street kid or something.
There was actually resentment within the German media.
Oh, yeah.
Prejudice against you because of the mullet.
A lot. They really thought I'm no good because, and that's sad in a way because, you know, who was I racing? I was racing Stefan Beloff, who was a mechanic. I was racing Manfred Winkelhock, who was a mechanic, both in the same year, tragically, in 1985. We lost them both.
And in sports cars?
In sports cars, yeah. Yeah, in the same championship. You know, you have a driver's briefing in the morning and a minus one guy in the evening. Oh, and that was tough times, you know, very tough. Coming back to the general situation I was in, the intellectual thing was one problem. The other problem was that I always decided to go to England. And I spent my entire racing life in the United Kingdom.
What made you do that?
Ah, very simple. When Dieter Stappart, who was then the BMW Motorsport director, he said to me, ideally, you should do Formula 3. I said, well, anything. I'll do anything. He then said, can't help you because we've only got a Formula 2 engine. And on top of that, this was after Renault 5 racing and after half a year of Procar M1. He said, all we can offer is the March works drive. I said, well, I'll take that then. And he gave me his car key. He said, okay, go to Bicester. So that's what I did. And I went to Bicester and stayed there because it was the heart of what I regarded proper racing. And March Engineering was a fabulous company. It was quite small, but they built Formula 3 cars and Formula 2 cars and Champ cars. Oh, no, Indy cars, sorry, Indy cars. And it was just fantastic.
And did you come into contact with Robin Hood and Max Mosley?
The whole lot. And this is what basically made me the person I am now, because my upbringing was British, in racing, was completely British. I was very lucky, you know. These days, the early 1980s, we're talking Thatcherism, we're talking the Falklands War, and, you know, I've seen all that, and the milkman was still, there was still milkman around. Little Christian was sitting in bloody Bicester in a Littlebury's hotel and had breakfast every morning and went to the March factory. But the good thing was that the engineers there were Gordon Coppock, who was the chief engineer there, Ralph Bellamy, who eventually became a very, very good friend and an incredible teacher for young Christian, the race car driver. there was Adrian Newey, and of course Robin and the old bunch of people. It was just incredible. And I, unlike all the other Germans who never went to England, said, no, I stay in Germany. Manfred Winkelhock, he was not interested. I just fucking loved it. I thought, this is fantastic. You know, they're building racing cars, and I can watch, you know, with the rivets and the sheet aluminium cars in these days. And I talked to Ralph Bellamy about the wind tunnel results. Imperial College, quarter scale, you know, small. But it was the same principle that's existing until today. And that really made me the person I am, because the way I look at a racing car, the way I look at racing as such, was created in these years in Kidlington and Croughton and Bicester, wherever I was.
Did getting under the bonnet and really learning about how the cars were being made and designed and everything, did that make you a better racing driver?
I don't think so. What made me a better race, but you know, don't forget, I'm not a mechanic, I'm a race car driver, you know, and there are reasons for it, because I very easily understood what I was doing. I was brought up in a way that every single second I'm in this car, I have to know what I'm doing and I have to report to my engineer, because poor old engineers in these days, they didn't have any sensors and data and nothing. So the only way for them to understand what the car does was the driver. So like that, I developed a very own driving style, which was a very smooth and very, I let the car do what it wanted to do, because it's, you know, if you interfere all the time with a racing car and you're correcting it and interfering it on dynamic weight balance and steering, the car is never speaking a clear language to you. So that's what I learned then. And vehicle dynamics and aerodynamics, all these things. Yeah, I learned a lot, and that made me clearly a better race car driver.
Okay, now, the lack of support at home, but Bernie Ecclestone was starting to get his grip on Formula One at this point. Did he give you a push?
No. I did my very first Formula One test in a Brabham, which was a Brabham BMW, and I didn't fit in the car, and I just did, I don't know, 8 laps around Rickard, and everybody was happy. Okay, we had the German in the car. Piero Martini was the test driver then, and he did miles and miles and miles, and I just hopped in, and Charlie, I know it was Herbie Blash ran the test, and it was all very funny, but it wasn't really a proper test. But Bernie did what he had to do for BMW, and that's why he put me in the car. But it was more or less we have to give him a whiz and then cross it off, and that's it.
How integral were BMW in your career?
Well, they were very important. Without BMW, I wouldn't have made it to Formula 2. And when they then dumped me, I was still in Formula 2, but there was unfortunately the Honda engine, which was a lot better. And only when Formula 3000 appeared, I could actually win races, and I had a lot of wins and a lot of good races. But BMW then came back in my motor racing life with a new motorsport director, because he said, Peter Flohr was his name, and he said, Christian, we should have put you in the Arrows in the first place, but it didn't work out, and I apologize. And that's how I eventually ended up in the Arrows, because Mark Surer had this rally accident, and I ended up in the Arrows in 1986. That was with the BMW engine and with BMW support.
Right, let's just cover off 85 though. You make that debut at Spa-Francorchamps, of all places. A very intimidating racetrack. You're replacing Jonathan Palmer at Zach Speed, who's injured. How much notice did you get? Did you get any testing prior to that?
No.
Just straight in. Yeah. Baptism of fire.
Yes. I mean, when I saw this wonderful story about Frank Williams, Frank, at one stage he was asked, what was the most wonderful attitude or, you know, about your wife? What can you say, who passed away quite early? And he said he thought he just sat there. And you know Frank, you remember him, yeah, when he was thinking. And he said, she just got on with it. And fuck, I love that, because that's what it is. Just the hell get on with it. No excuses, you know, just get on with it. And that's your mantra, I'm sensing. Absolutely my mantra. I'm very optimistic. I'm very positive. I never give in. It's not my attitude. But get on with it helps you around a lot of obstacles.
What was the Zach Speed in 1985 like to drive? I mean, that first race you qualified, I think, 22nd. The gearbox went in the race. But Was it a massive step up from 3,000?
No, it was a massive step back because the, don't forget, the 1985 March Formula 3000 car was an incredibly good car. I mean, the trouble was that half of the field was running that car, but the car was sensational. It was up to spec race car engineering and technology. It was a flat bottom car with a rake, arse up, which I tested at Snetterton for the first time. And Ralph Bellamy told me that, you know, we should try to run the car like that because it gives you more downforce. I was as skeptical as everybody. They had the back end of the car quite high up, and it had much more downforce. It was very clear. So that car was a very well-designed and manufactured racing car. The Saxby didn't go straight on a straight. It was horrible.
Are you exaggerating when you say
no,
that?
No. I was going through Eau Rouge up to Kemmel, and I thought that, well, it was a bit tricky with the turbo engines and stuff, and the gearbox was very bad. The linkage was very poor. You could hardly find the gears, and so the gear change took forever, which I wasn't used to. I was used to British race car engineering, and this thing didn't. It was not good at all. Ask Jonathan; he should know. He should remember.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So you do two races, and then for 86, the opportunity, we'll talk about Arrows in a bit, but for the start of the season, you were in the Osella, the underpowered Alfa Romeo engine. How did you end up there?
Well, it was the only car left. I mean, it was the kind of Minardi of these days, you know. It's better to put your foot, to get your foot into the business like that, but staying away from it. So that's how I ended up there.
I mean, for the younger people listening to this who don't remember these times, what was the plight of Osella? Were they the Haas of that
era?
Oh,
no. Oh, no, no, no. Well, you see, I really appreciate that you kind of mentioned the now and the young people, because I don't like talking about the past all the time, although it might be very interesting and there's a lot of stories to be told. But the really interesting bit is you've done the past and you're actually alive and living in the now, which gives you a different point of view and the actual day-to-day Formula One problems that you have every fortnight or every week on the Grand Prix weekend are the things that are talked about in social media. And in these days, there wasn't anything like that. It was just Formula One. And Osella was a small Formula One team. And you could not compare it with Haas, because Haas might be small and very economic or whatever, you know, but it's a fast car. I mean, you can actually finish in the top 10 more or less all the time. And that is something very different to an Osella, because the Osella had a fuel capacity of a tank of 220, 230 liters of gas. The engine needed to finish the race 250, 260.
My maths isn't great, but how can you end up with a fuel tank that's too small?
Because it was these cars had very big fuel tanks already because of the turbo engines in these days were very inefficient. They needed a lot of fuel also for cooling. As soon as the boost went up, you needed more fuel, but also for cooling. Otherwise, you got detonation on the pistons and everything. So it was a different era.
But you entered every race knowing.
Oh, yeah. I knew beforehand.
That you weren't going to finish.
Yeah.
And yet you were still happy to do it.
Yeah. I loved driving Formula One cars. You know, why? I'm now 66 years of age. I still come to as many races as I can. I've done a quarter of a century, really, without missing a single Grand Prix. You don't do that unless you really love it. You enjoy it. You love it. You think it's the best thing on planet Earth. That's how I got into the business, and that's how I stayed in the business. You know?
It seems to me, then, that the first real opportunity for you was Arrows.
Yes.
Mid-86. Mark Sura has that terrible rally crash. But you only had less than a week to get your head around it because you were in the Osella in Canada, and then a week later,
Detroit.
You were in the Arrows.
Renaissance Center. What a circuit. Well, you see, the Arrows thing was in itself a bit of a problem because the car we raced was the car from the year before. Terry and Gerhard raced the car in 85. The very same car was raced in 86 because they couldn't get the new car ready for whatever reason. And I knew Terry from Formula 2, Terry Bootson. He was solidly quick, I tell you. I mean, the guy was hard to beat. Luckily, I managed to beat him, so that was all fine for me. The car was a heap of junk. It was so bad. It wasn't as bad as the Sack Speed from 85, but it wasn't an easy car to drive. It was a beast with a lot of power, with a lot of... The car's never seen a wind tunnel, as an example. Never. The most funny thing is my race engineer, Pete Ellery, who eventually designed the Bentley Le Mans car, you know, this guy, he wrote an article in Race Car Engineering, I think it was, about that particular car and where the problems were. And he said that was probably one of the worst cars he's ever worked on or designed because it was just a floppy tub. And it was, for those of you who have seen a lot of different generations of Formula One cars, there's always been one fundamental problem, which is called lack of structural integrity. That was in the 1970s a huge problem. It eventually was getting better with carbon fiber and things like that. But this is a gremlin that's sleeping in a lot of racing cars until now. It's just a lot easier to design these cars now because you have a lot of tools that help you calculating how... Not just how strong, but also how stiff. Strong means it doesn't break. Stiff means it keeps its position, which is something that Arrows was... Well, you know, do we know what the name was of that car?
I don't remember.
Well, you know, Sebastian Vettel always had his Margherita and whatever, his wonderful names for his Ferraris. This car was called Wobbly Wendy. That's what it fucking was.
Right. But at least you had a decent engine and a fuel tank big enough.
Yeah. To last, I finished races and I even finished in the points.
Yeah.
But you see, the funny thing is, you know, I had quite a few seventh and eighth, which is nothing. It was nothing. The top six got the points. And when I finished sixth in Austria, my first world championship point, all the lads said, well done, but we want more. Which I thought was a quite remarkable way to say thank you, Christian. It's the only point we made in that year.
Tell me about Terry Bootson. It was a good battle between the two of you.
Oh, yeah.
And how frustrating was it that he then gets the leg up to Benetton the following season? And, you know, and Warwick and Shiva come in and replace both of you.
Yeah. Well, the biggest problem was that Ross Braun ended up being the chief designer at Arrows, and that was what made the difference. So the car was actually quite a good car. That was annoying, but, you know, the shit happens. What can you do? Get on with it.
Well, and you get on with it. You go back to Zach Speed, almost becoming your home in Formula One. Martin Brundle is your...
He was my teammate. Then,
was your teammate. And I did want to ask, who was harder to beat, Brundle or Bootsen?
Bootsen.
Really?
Yeah.
Fundamentally quicker than Martin? Or?
No, a different style. Brundle was a little volatile occasionally. He was very quick, and there was no doubt about it, but his driving was sometimes closer to an explosion, but an event, which was, I was very impressed about that. But Terry was just hardcore fast. He was fast all the time, every lap. He had no weak points. And with Martin, you always knew that, turn one is a good chance to say goodbye. But with Bootsen, he never did anything wrong. He was very, very good.
Look, something very interesting that I'd love you to talk to me about happened at Monaco in 87. There was an incident between you and Alboreto in Q1. And then, for reasons that I don't fully understand, you were excluded from the weekend. Can you talk us through it?
I was going up the hill to the casino on a fresh set of tyres. These tyres had stickers on. You could see the guy is on a fresh set of tyres. It was free practice. And Alboreto came from behind and drove into me. That's the whole story. The car disintegrated, gearbox torn apart, fire, everything. And my car wasn't damaged too badly. But the race director then decided to disqualify me because of dangerous driving. I still don't understand how come, because I didn't do anything wrong. And the guy from behind was the guy who created the chaos. But I was disqualified. I was the first driver in the history of Formula One that got disqualified because of dangerous driving. The race director was a guy called Jackie Hicks. And I, to be perfectly honest, I never forgive him for that. Never. Because it was
Jackie,
wrong.
I mean... Listen, we've had Jackie Hicks on the show. He's a racing driver, a very successful one, very fast one. Why couldn't he see it from your point of view?
Because I think there was a lot of politics involved. Marco Piccinini was the Ferrari racing director. He was
Chris,
there.
Sorry to interrupt, but Michele Alboreto didn't blame you. He said afterwards that it was a typical Monaco incident.
Well, the guy who saved my ass at the end of the day was Ayrton Senna, because Senna was following... And he could see what happened. And he knew exactly that I didn't do anything wrong. And, Ayrton was a very special character. And I always liked him a lot. And I don't want to say I adored him because he was opposition. But I always liked him a lot. But after that afternoon in Monaco, I thought he's the greatest guy on planet Earth. Because what he did was he got the press together. But this was different to now. Ayrton was he usually had... the moments where he was trying to talk or communicate with the press, he just positioned himself somewhere in the paddock and they all came around him and there was a big circle. Everybody was listening and stuck the microphones towards him. And he then initiated this little PR conference just out of the blue saying, I just want to say one thing. That guy, Danner, he's fine. He's not done anything wrong. He was made a scapegoat for whatever reason, but it's wrong. The decision is wrong to disqualify him. And that saved my ass in Germany because everybody thought, the guy is nuts. I mean, how can he be disqualified because of dangerous driving? So, yes, you have to cope with it and yet again get on with it because it doesn't help. You can complain, you can argue, but it was wrong, clearly, but... Yeah, I don't even know who to blame, but that was it just happened.
You know how nowadays the drivers have to go and explain themselves to the stewards?
Yeah, yeah.
So did you actually have a conversation with Jackie Hicks?
Yes, I had.
With Alboreto in the room as well?
No. The stewards then were different people. I remember one, a Dutch guy called John Korsmit. He was clearly the head steward then, and there was some marshals reporting that it's my fault, marshals from the track. But I think they were probably Ferrari fans or whatever. No, I just had to cross it off and, get on with it. It was not very pleasant.
How did the team deal with it?
Not very... solidarity wasn't the biggest attitude of Mr. Sackspeed and the team, or loyalty as such. They just said, okay, we have to accept and run one car, which was Martin's car, and that was it.
Did it knock your confidence?
No, not at all. No, it was very annoying. And it was, well, I spoke to Ayrton a little later, and he actually cheered me up. He said, come on, just forget it, cross it off. This is not right. And I told everybody, and that was fine. And that helped me a lot. And I was not losing any confidence by any means. No, I was luckily strong enough a character.
So you think all of the drivers supported you?
Yes, absolutely.
Because that's the fundamental difference. I was just sort of trying to think back. Had this happened before? And the only thing that comes close to it is what happened to Patrese after Monza in 78. But that was the drivers turning against Ricciardo.
No, that was, in my case, absolutely no problem.
Yeah. Do you think this in any way contributed to you not getting a drive in 88?
No, because I had a drive in 1988. The trouble was that I signed for Ligier. And I was in France, and I had a meeting with Guy Ligier. We had lunch. We drank a bottle of red wine. He kissed me, and I signed, and it was all done. The trouble was that Michel Tetteau, who was the chief designer then at Ligier's, he decided to design a pretty awkward car, which was a two-tank car. It had a tank behind the driver's back, then the engine, then a second tank, and then the gearbox. It was for weight distribution, but what I mentioned earlier on, the lack of structural integrity caught them out big time. Unfortunately, I was simply too tall for the car because they had a carbon roll hoop and they couldn't change it anymore. And I didn't fit in the car because these cars had the feet behind the front axle center line, fine. And the rest of the car was, there was no definition for it. It was as small as you could build it or make it, or you think you had to make it. Have a look at the 89 Leighton House that Adrian built, or speak to Gugelmin or to Ivan Capelli. I mean, the car was virtually undrivable from a size point of view. So I was always a little bit on the tall side of things, and that's why they then decided, we can't fit you in the car, sorry, the contract has immediately expired, which was annoying, but...
What stage of the winter was this?
The car was already built.
So it was late?
Late, yeah. Stefan Johansson drove the car, okay. And he's still angry with me that I didn't drive it, because the car, I don't think, was a wonderful piece of machinery.
No. But I've also read that you had conversations with Ken Tyrrell.
Yes.
And was size a similar problem?
No, with Ken it was kind of different because these, you know, Ron Dennis or Ken Tyrrell or these guys, they had their own idea about what they wanted. And that there was, it was very simple. Don't call us, we call you. And you just had to wait and see. Ever since I was spoiled in my younger days with March and all the British race car engineering, I thought I deserve coming back into a proper English Formula One car. But it never really happened.
No. How close do you think did you get to Tyrrell?
I can't tell. There was a moment where I was hoping very much we get it together. And then there was the don't call us, we call you moment. And then I said, well, okay, probably not.
Christian, you strike me as a very tenacious character. You're about 30 years old at this time. You go and race in the DTM, in the German Touring Car Championship in 1988. Were you still hopeful of a return to Formula One? Was that still first in your mind?
I tell you, that lasted quite long. Yes, of course. And in 1988, I raced for Alpina, BMW Alpina and DTM, and that was fun, but it was ridiculous. The car had 300 brake horsepower. It had no downforce. It was fun, but it wasn't anything that I could happily live with for the rest of my racing driver's life. And of course, I was completely optimistic. I will be back in Formula One, which eventually happened with Real in 89. But when I lost the drive there at the end of 89, I had an offer from BMW to become the Snitzer BMW number one, you're going to win the championship for us driver.
In touring cars.
In touring cars, German championship or world championship, whatever it was. And I turned it down. And the guy, the boss, Mr. Kalbfell, he couldn't believe it. He said, well, Christian, this is an offer not everybody gets. I said, yeah, but I want to continue racing in single-seaters. And what I did, I went to Japan because Mr. Akagi, you know, the guy, the owner of Leighton House, at that stage decided he wanted to have two Formula One teams. He had Leighton House Racing and Leighton House Engineering. So he wanted both to be from one team. So Adrian and them lot, they did one part, and I was supposed to do the other part. So I developed a Mugen engine and all the Bridgestone tire stuff. Unfortunately, the Formula One drive that I had in mind didn't really happen because they locked Mr. Akagi up because of falsified securities fraud issues. But I had a good year in Japan.
So pounding round Suzuka, improving the Mugen
43
engine.
43 days of Formula One testing round Suzuka.
What was the chassis?
It was a Reynard. Malcolm Osler designed it. The tub was something like a stretch 3000 car, and aero was fairly spooky. But the engine was good and the tires were good. So with Hamashima, we're Hammy.
Of course, who came in with Bridgestone in
a couple of years later.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, so you get the Real drive, 489. You finish fourth in Phoenix.
Mm. Unfortunately, only fourth because bloody Eddie Cheever didn't break down a lap early.
How tough was that race in Phoenix?
Phoenix, Arizona was clearly hotter, but it was very dry, so that helped. I didn't have any problems doing the race, apart from a broken exhaust in the last few laps.
Reliability was fine. Physically, you were fine.
Physically, I was absolutely fine. No problem.
That was the highest point for you?
Yep.
In F1. Did it feel sweet?
Well, no, because Eddie finished third. And I knew he was about to break down. He was crawling over the line. And I said, shit, it's one more lap and I would have been on the podium.
And did you know that at the time?
Yeah, when you were in the car?
I knew. Okay, so actually still a little bit of frustration.
Fine, you know. It was good because the car was, the 89 Real was a very, very bad car for the same reasons, lack of structural integrity. Unfortunately, that car was at the monocoque, the tub was built in Germany. In England, all the carbon technology was very advanced by then. And to build a carbon fiber monocoque, a race car chassis in Germany in these days, the thing was so floppy and it fell to pieces eventually. And it was only years later when Gunther Schmidt, the owner of the team, admitted and he said, well, Jesus Christ, I should have given you a proper tub and you would have finished into points quite frequently. Well, it doesn't help, does it?
You're a great advocate for the racing industry in the UK.
I am. Yes, I'm German. I'm from Munich. Well, I'm Bavarian country near Germany. But what most of the people, even nowadays in the paddock, don't realize that, you know, haven't worked with all the engineers I mentioned earlier on, haven't dealt with people like Bob Sparshot. I mean, Bob Sparshot, the most wonderful, wonderful man I ever came across. So Alan Jakeman, you know, Jakey's father, you know, the guy who was the chief mechanic at Williams eventually. These guys ran Brett Lunger's car back in 75 or 6. Bob was working for Team Lotus. These characters taught me what racing is all about. It's a spirit. It lives in everybody involved. A British race car mechanic gives the last drop of blood for half a tenth of performance. And I learned so much from these people because they love their car. And Sparshot was just phenomenal. You know, he just had a look at the car all the time. He wanted to see every bolt and every nut. And it was just fabulous. I felt great to be working with him.
We've mentioned some great racing drivers in our chat. You mentioned Senna. We've mentioned Alboreto. Can we just compare and contrast that era in the 80s to now? The strength and depth that we have on the grid now. This is you with your punditry commentator head
on.
Yes,
yeah.
Versus what there was in the 80s. Do you feel that the grid is stronger now than it was in the 80s?
From a driver point of view, no. It's always been fantastic. There's nothing to complain about. The difference is that the cars are a lot better. Even at Sauber thing, who finished last or second last the other week, is a car that's probably 1.5 seconds slower than a McLaren. Or maybe 1.8, but not more than that. So the difference in the cars on the grid was phenomenal. I mean, there was a lot of junk at the back end of the grid. And that is the difference. Sometimes people ask me, you know, what would you be world champion in a Williams? Would have been world champion in a Williams. Well, my problem was I was up against Ayrton. No way I can beat Ayrton. Nigel Mansell in his days was fucking phenomenally quick because he was always carrying the weight penalty. Don't forget, Nigel was always about 10 kilos heavier than the rest of them. And in his days, you didn't deduct the driver's weight. It was part of the package. So Nigel was sensationally quick. Alain Prost, would have been able to beat Prost? I don't think so. Nelson Piquet, well, yes, but only towards the end of his career. In the beginning, no. Who else was there? Well, and then we end up with the Gerhard Burgers and the Patrese's. Yeah, but these are the drivers with, I don't know, 2, 3, 5, 6 Grand Prix wins. That's the category where I believe I could have performed too in the right cars. But a world champion, I don't think I'd made it. No. But to be absolutely honest, it's hard to admit, but no.
Christian, you know, you talk about, you know, how brilliant the Sennas and the Prosts and the Mansells were. Do you think, you know, today's superstars, the Hamiltons, Leclercs, Verstappens, are they on the same level as
yes.
those people you mentioned from the 80s?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just slightly different because the tiny freaking details they have to live with and work on are a lot more difficult than what we had to cope with. I think the superstars of today, you mentioned Lewis as an example, or Max, now Lando Norris or Oscar Piastri coming up and stuff, these guys are just as good as the top drivers in the 1980s. But for me, I always rated drivers not like he's super good and super fast, nobody else is going to catch him. Every racing driver had his era. It either there was a match or not. Fangio had a match with his era because he could drive these particular cars more quickly than most of the others. The same happened to the 1980s when I was racing in Formula One. The same happened later on with Michael. And, you know, the only guy who survived all this was Alonso. Groove tires, 2.7-liter engines, 10 cylinders, 8 cylinders, turbo, hybrid. Alonso was always quick. He gets a lot of extra points for that, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I was going to ask you, when we look at today's grid, can you give me your top three?
Well, Max, Lando and Lewis, yeah.
1, 2, 3, in that order?
No, same level. I spoke a lot to Nicky. I was very friendly with Nicky Lauda because we worked for the same television station. We sat together every weekend and we chatted along and along. So he told me a lot about Lewis. And I met Lewis a few times. I think he is sensational. He's absolutely sensational. However, he was always given a car which highlighted him being very, very, very special. So you always need both. And the same is with Lando now in the McLaren, the same is with Max in the Red Bull. But these people, even in the second best car, the third best car, they overperform. And that's why I admire them just as much as I did with the Senna's and the Prost's in these days. It's a different era. You have to be able to actually do different things in the car, you know, with the data and always speaking to the engineers and stuff. You have to look after the tires differently. And so, I mean, that we didn't have. Just go balls out. And if the tires are fucked, you know, just come in, let us know with a finger. But, you know, things have changed. And the parameters that made a race car driver a superior race car driver or a phenomenally good race car driver, they have clearly changed. A gear shift, looking after the gearbox downshift, not over-revving an engine, that's all gone. They were parameters in the 1980s. If you couldn't cope with this, it was a dead car every weekend. Now, it's just changed. There's a few other parameters that come along with the modern technologies, which you have to cope with. And I think at the end of the day, the technology has clearly changed, but it's four wheels, throttle, pedal, and a brake, and even a clutch.
Well, some people say, oh, wouldn't it be good if a manual gearbox came back to Formula One, because it was such an art form, heel and toeing and things. Where do you stand on that?
Well, a manual box, you know, you're talking an H-box, not a sequential box. Sequential boxes are easy to just go wallop, 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 and that's it.
I'm talking
about a proper H-box with double clutching on a downshift. That was an art because it had a great effect on the corner entry speed. Because if you cock it up, going into the corner, you lock up the rear end of the car, and that's not very pleasant at all. You know, you cannot uninvent things. Just live with it, and that's it. It's just different. It's still difficult to drive a Formula One car quickly.
Christian, it's been an absolute joy to speak to you and to relive just, I think, what was a fantastic era of Formula One. I think the 80s was a pioneer. There was a pioneering spirit, I think, among the designers and the drivers. So,
well, you're right, but let me say one thing at the end of our little conversation here. There are drivers out there talking about the past and how great it was and how fantastic it was. And that I don't like, because it was fantastic, but mainly because we were young. Don't forget that. Now you've gone through all the shit that life provides for you occasionally, and you look back and say, well, then it was good. But it was good because you hadn't swallowed so much unpleasant stuff. Now is what matters. And I'm ever so happy to be following Formula One and motor racing as such, also Formula E and whatever else is happening. I just love motor racing. However, I do not live in the past. I'm ever so happy to be alive now, here and today. And when I look back, I don't look back in anger. I'm happy.
Your passion.
Yes.
Shines bright, Christine. Look, thank you. Can I just end this in the traditional way now on the show, which is we have some quick fire questions.
Yeah.
What else are you good at?
Cross-country skiing.
Probably very fit as well.
Yes.
Not
fit enough, though.
Which racing person, dead or alive, would you want to be stuck in a lift with?
Oof. Clearly not Jonathan Palmer, because he can't stop talking. He's a chatterbox, you know. It's a very funny, but no, not Jonathan. Difficult question.
A designer or driver?
No, probably one of them American heroes like Rutherford or, you know, these kind of guys.
Johnny Rutherford, yeah, really?
I never met these people. Because the Formula One lot, I had plenty of chance to talk to pretty much everyone around. So I don't need a Formula One driver.
Who was your hero growing up?
Joe Siffert. Swiss guy. Siffert,
I can see Rodriguez,
Redman. Yeah, these three is good.
Next one. Who would play you in a film?
Oof. I wish it was Johnny Depp.
It can be, right? Just a couple more. Who is the coolest person in your address book, in your contacts?
The coolest person is in my address book is probably Ralph Bellamy. He's so cool. He's still engineering racing cars. He's 80-something now. Lives down in Surfers Paradise in Australia. Yeah, he's the coolest person, yeah.
Look, final one. If you hosted a podcast like this, who would be your first guest?
You. Yeah, because I can say that you've got plenty of experience in this business. You know, we obviously have a chance to have a good chat. So that's what it's all about. I never thought that podcasts have to be an interview thing. It must be like you and I are sitting on a sofa and chatting along, you know, having a good drink and having a good time. That's what a podcast should be like. And that's why, yes, you.
Okay, I'm available. I'd love to do it.
Good.
Christian, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Brilliant. Well, Christian, how about some skiing followed by a podcast? I like the sound of that. And I love this chat. Christian's enthusiasm for the sport is infectious, and that must shine through in his commentary work today. He has a wonderful way of explaining things, and it was great to get the lowdown on his controversial disqualification from Monaco in 1987. Christian, thanks for your time, and I'll see you at a racetrack again soon. So what did you make of this chat? How many of you can remember that 1986 Arrows Wobbly Wendy? Let me know your thoughts through all the usual means. I'm at Tom Clarkson F1, or you can use the hashtag F1 Beyond the Grid. Which, of course, brings me on to what you sent in about last week's show with the great Fernando Alonso. There's so much love out there for Fernando, as summed up in this message from Francium11. Thoroughly enjoyed this excellent interview. Thank you. Loved hearing Fernando's thoughts about his Ferrari days. Many may have forgotten or are new fans unaware of just how amazing Ferrari Fernando was. It's clear Alonso loved Ferrari just as they loved him. Hope to see a 500th race from him. Well, thanks for getting in touch, and who knows about 500? 450 is looking increasingly likely, so let's see about 500. That's almost it for this week. If you want to listen to more F1, please head over to F1 Nation, where our review of the Mexico City Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by former F1 driver Esteban Gutierrez and F1 TV presenter Laura Winter to reflect on that sensational win for Carlos Sainz. Or how about the latest episode of F1 Explains? It's a live show from the US Grand Prix with Mika Hakkinen and Ollie Bearman. Both of those shows are available on your podcast app now. Thanks for listening. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.